Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Junior Doan's The Spark. I'm Junior Doan, and thank you for joining us. With me today is Ambassador John Rakolta, Jr. Ambassador Rakolta served as the United States Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from 2019 to 2021, and he is currently the chairman of Wallbridge, one of the largest construction contractors in the United States. Welcome, John. Ambassador, you are in the midst of a stellar career, both in business at Wallbridge, at the charities trying to improve things in Michigan, particularly for students in Detroit, and now as co-chairman of the Build Michigan Better Council. And you had a glorious experience, I hope, when you were our ambassador to the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. So tell me, how did it all start?
Well, first, let me just say good morning to you, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. It all started, obviously, a long, long time ago with a set of parents who set no boundaries in terms of what can be achieved in life. My family comes from Romania. My grandfather immigrated here when he was 13 and insisted that his children get the first-class education, and that all resulted in my parents having very, very high expectations and standards that I had to meet. We were very, very fortunate to have a family business, a business called Wallbridge. And from my earliest days, 12 years old, I started working here at Summers. And that experience in itself sort of showed what could be accomplished by the fruits of your hard work and your labor and your success. And, you know, we've just grown from there. We've had a marvelous experience for the last many, many decades, punctuated by moments of extreme pride and privilege when I was the ambassador to the UAE and being able to represent my country. And I have to tell you, I don't think there was any moment in my life where I felt prouder or perhaps more connected back to our country, being away from it and seeing how others had to live and the kind of governments that they were subjugated to, and just so blessed and honored to be an American.
What do you think are the skills you needed to develop or intrinsically had to be successful for the company future?
Well, in my particular case, I was a STEM student, science, technology, English, and math, and you know, the ability to communicate both verbally and in writing, I think is a skill that is as important today as it's ever been, with a multitude of media that you're able to communicate to. In addition to a first-class education, I believe that you need to have a work ethic is the number one quality and goal that every single person needs to strive for. Not only does it bring you a lot of self-satisfaction, you feel worthy and worthwhile. Your life has many, many positive aspects to it. And so work ethic for me is number one. But secondly, you have to start to look at other characteristics that make our society so strong and so vibrant. And to me, the number one is safety in everything that you do. I happen to be in a very difficult business, construction, and safety is our number one core value that every single person can return home safely at night. I don't think there's a single person in the world that goes to work in the morning or travels outside their home figuring they won't make it back that evening. In addition to that, you know, it's those standard things that you hear about all the time: honesty, integrity, producing added value, building trust and loyalty, a relentless pursuit of success through teamwork and innovation. All of these things are what make me successful, and establishing a set of core values that you live by every single day that won't change no matter what happens in life, I think are essential to anyone's success in life and their ultimate happiness.
What are the core values for you?
I think I just repeated most of them. First of all, I want to express my belief in God and how I think that faith and, in my case, religion plays a significant role in my life. Next is my family and how important they are. And at the end of the day, you know, keeping my family together, both immediate and extended, is of vital importance to me and to the happiness of everybody. And then my business and how I interrelate with my team members and, you know, the strategic vision that we're able to share, the trust. You know, I've often said that leaders in the world today really need two things. Number one, they do have to have a good vision of the future and where we're headed. But that needs to be backed up with trust. And that trust has to come from the loyal members on your team that are taking a risk with you, because anytime you have a vision, you, in effect, are going to make change. And that in itself has a lot of consequences. There are hopefully not too many losers, but people don't like to change. It's there's a big fear in change today.
Can hard work be taught? Can you learn it?
Absolutely. I think you learn it from early life. You witness your parents, what they do. Chores in the beginning make you responsible, not only for yourself and for others. And so, yeah, I think hard work is a learned skill. But I also think there has to be a component of reward to it. And just to work hard and have no reward or an adequate reward, then that becomes a problem and people start to wonder what it is all about. And I think that's one of the issues that we have in society today, that the rewards are not commensurate any longer with the amount of effort that is put in by many, many citizens around the world.
Interesting point. How could that change for the better?
Well, I think the biggest thing is education. The more education you have, obviously the higher your income, the more choices you have in life. And the second thing is to, you know, have an equal or a fair distribution, is probably a better word, of the spoils of society, of the rewards that are out there. You know, minimum wage is probably way too low in today's society. And, you know, many employers don't treat their employees the way they should. And that's why you have strikes and unions. But as my company goes, we've always tried to share the profitability and make success opportunities available to a diverse group of people.
What in the volunteer sector did you have to learn to be effective there? Because perhaps they are motivated somewhat differently than the people who are working at Walbridge.
You know, we've always had this philosophy of a shareholder ownership of our company, as opposed, I misspoke there. I should have said that while most companies are shareholder driven, we've sort of changed the dynamics of that and look at our company as a company made up of stakeholders. And those stakeholders are certainly the shareholders of the company, but we've identified five stakeholder groups that we think have to benefit from the existence and the profitability of the company. Now, certainly the employees. Secondly, our customers. Thirdly, our supply base of vendors and subcontractors and material men. The fourth would be the community at large, where we exist. And finally, the environment. We think all five of those stakeholders deserve a piece of the pie, if you will. And we strive as a company not only to ingrain that in our employees, but we also strive to make sure that every one of those stakeholder groups benefit from the existence of Walbridge.
Can you transfer that to the volunteer sector, that approach, or have you learned that there's a different approach for success in the volunteer education sector, you might say?
I think everything I've said applies to virtually every quadrant of society. That return to the community is what drives us to be so involved in civic and charitable organizations, to give of our time and treasure, and to make sure that it's of significant value. And I've always, since the beginning of my business career, always felt that I have a big responsibility, maybe even further obligation to the community at large, and to try to help help solve some of the bigger issues that are out there.
I'm thinking about what you said, because you're a high energy guy who's got a lot of bounds and ideas. How do you take people with you on the newer ideas?
Well, I think you first have to convince them that your vision is a good one and they have the same value system as you have. But speaking of energy, I think that you have to be a warrior in the sense of taking care of yourself first. And so I preach that you have to be physically fit in many, many ways. Good sleep, a steady diet, a proper body weight, things of that nature. Secondly, I think you have to be mentally strong. And you have to recognize that all people, include high energy people, have moments of, you know, depression and moments of exhilaration. And you have to try to smooth that line out so that you don't get too caught up in the highs and you don't let the lows really affect you that much. And then finally, I think there's a spiritual component to all of our lives. We're all asking, what is our purpose? Why are we here? How can I better not only my own state, but that of others? And when you add all three of those together and all three of them are firmly planted, you have a steady foundation in which to go forward in. On the other hand, if you lose one of those three, just imagine yourself sitting on a three-legged stool, it becomes a little bit more difficult if you only have two of those legs. You're constantly having to balance in yourself and redirecting your energies toward that balance. If you only have one, it's even more difficult than if you had two or three. So those three components of an individual, I think, are the starting point of what we're talking about today, and that is, you know, complete happiness throughout your life.
So how do you handle setbacks or mistakes? Because they can be in any area, health, business, diplomacy, anything. What have you learned or what do you practice?
Well, they're there. And you're not going to avoid them. And so you're right, you have to learn how to deal with them. And my first step is to reflect on what my role has been in getting to that point. What could I have done differently, rather than right away looking to the outside and pointing fingers to others? I think there's a real benefit in that self-reflection. It sets you up for what we would call here at Walbridge a really good lessons learned process. And the more you go through those lessons learned, and you really take a deep look at those problems that you're alluding to, you begin to figure out ways of eliminating many, many of those problems. And I think that's the bottom line here. We're never going to eliminate them all, but we want to reduce them to the smallest number that we possibly can, and to accept responsibility for those problems that we have and learn how we can avoid them in the future.
I actually feel the same way, and therefore I take responsibility. Things go wrong, I blame myself first, or because I have say over action and development of thought. I don't believe in victim talk because it makes you frozen in a sense. And I think life is meant to move, in these areas. But one of the things I do that I don't hear done, maybe done at Walbridge, but I don't hear it done, at least in the charitable section or even in the political section, is to ask about proposed ideas and things that could be done, to play them out. How will they play out? And what will the effect be on 25 years from now, 50 years from now, 10 years from now? Just to see, or can there be something in it that you can self-regulate the project? Is that something to consider, or if I'm off on a limb there?
No, I think that's certainly a part of coming up with the right decision. I would also add that I think in the sense of not-for-profits, that there isn't any one owner, if you will, of the business. Not-for-profits are controlled by a board of directors. And what I have seen in the past is that when it comes to tough discussions and tough decision-making, many, many not-for-profits and charitable organizations like to avoid those kind of tough decisions until the time where it's too late. And so, you know, I always felt in any not-for-profit that I was on, that whatever we're doing at the end of the board meeting, there has to be an executive session where the leadership the executive director, the president, the paid staff leave the room, and the volunteer board of directors can have a real good assessment of where are we, have we actually accomplished what we've set out to do, and what's the direction we're going in the future. And having that unvarnished is really difficult if everybody's in the room. And I think it's the responsibility of various boards to have what I call those executive sessions. And so whenever I'm asked to join a board, I always insist that that be part of the agenda. And that's also true on the public boards that I sit on, for-profit corporations, that we do have those executive sessions where we can have a real good back and forth as to the real state of affairs and not varnish them over because too many people are in the room and we don't want to hurt any feelings.
I'm glad we're going in this direction because have been a volunteer much of my life. I feel the role of an executive volunteer has been diminished and the role of the professionals has been accelerated or dominating. So you miss a broader reaction somewhat. So I'm glad to hear about that. I haven't really heard about that approach before, but certainly worth doing. And also, I think that a board of directors, they ought to stand outside after annual meetings that aren't on Zoom and talk to people. And for reasons you might get different questions. But I would like to know, what's the best way to approach you, or not on my part, but just on anybody's part, about a new idea or something they think differently than you do? What would help you listen the most? Or do you listen?
I do. I really enjoy intellectual tension. I think intellectual tension is missing in society today because we are so polarized. I think it's the way that we can come back together if we develop really strong listening skills and try to put ourselves in other person's shoes before defending. And I think in today's world, we are doing way, way too much defending. And by doing that, I sort of equate it to cage fighting. You come out swinging, and there never is an opportunity to meet somewhere in the middle. Now, many times you can't, but I have learned in my past that when I do this and practice this in the way that I've just described, I've changed my mind in many issues too. I find myself being perhaps a little bit more compromising, understanding a little bit better what's driving the other person, what don't I know that's happening in the background, and generally can come up with a reasonable solution for both parties. I don't think that's happening today. And, you know, I'm to a large degree appalled by the state of the political affairs in our country. There is no diplomacy in politics today. There is no middle ground. There is no talking to the opposite side. There is no bipartisanship. Everything is polarized. And I think it's to the detriment of our country and to our future. And what I've tried to do with my involvement in the Growing Michigan Together Council, which is the Population Council in short, is to try to show that a Republican myself can reach across the aisle to a Democrat like Governor Whitmer, and that we can accomplish something for the betterment of the people of the state of Michigan, nothing to do with ourselves. I'm not paid. I get nothing out of it, but I do feel compelled and driven by the fact that somehow we have to break this gridlock as a society, both locally, statewide, nationally, and on an international stage, and find and go back to some of the old, tried and proven ways of what I would call soft power.
Have you considered that others may not want to do that?
Absolutely. I know they won't. And I think there's example after example where you put yourself at risk and they come after you. But that's part of the price you have to pay. If you want to make change and if you want to do good in society today, you have to be prepared to take those risks. And occasionally you get wounded, you get nicked. But in the end of the day, I think it works and it has. And my case, there's been three substantive issues that I have dealt with in the past. One was race here in the city of Detroit and the polarization of black and white America. And I found a way to be able to speak about black and white issues directly with black individuals. I think that America has not reached that point yet, and that pains me greatly. The second is the Detroit public school system was on the verge of bankruptcy. It was after the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit, and the state played an unfortunate, significant role in creating that dynamic, and I joined a group of a coalition to try to change that, and we were very, very successful. And by the way, all that frank dialogue, direct and honest, took place behind closed doors, and sometimes it was difficult to hear, and sometimes it was personal, but we all agreed not to hold each other responsible for what had taken place, just wanted to make sure that there was a good outcome in the future. And quite frankly, that's what happened with the Abraham Accords. You know, there have been 25 years since there was any peace in the Middle East. And I had the privilege of serving as a political appointed ambassador to the UAE, the first one in its history. And through the good offices of the president and his chief advisor, Jared Kushner, we were able to build a bridge between Israel and the UAE. And ultimately what came out of that was the Abraham Peace Accords. And again, that took a lot of listening, a lot of soul searching. What role could we play? And was the timing right? So yes, I'm prepared to get nicked. I'm prepared to get shot at. I'm prepared to be humiliated. But I think at the end of the day, when you put all the factors together that we've spoken about, spirituality, good health, mental preparedness, and the need to return to society, pay it forward, it's all well worth it.
Congratulations on that achievement right there. There's some aspect of life is good. I feel the younger generation hasn't gotten to, or at least what I've read about them, because there's a whole group that's very ambitious and very together. But you have a goal of, you've mentioned in an interview, actually, that you want Michigan to continue to be the premier state for auto production. And you're concerned about these years that we're missing the mark in collaboration, cooperation, or change in whatever. Would you say a word about that? What are our chances? What needs to be done? It's a perfect example of getting people together for a common good.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I learned a big lesson in 2008 when we were part of the Volkswagen team trying to select where Volkswagen would build its first assembly plant. The team ultimately selected Tennessee over Michigan. Michigan was a strong finalist. I went to the ownership of the Volkswagen in Wolfsburg, Germany, and asked them why Michigan lost. And they said one word, cohesion. And they went on to explain that of all the states that they had looked at, Michigan was the least cohesive. Labor and management were not aligned. We had failed to solve our black-white issue, racial issue. Our political establishment was at odds at each other, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even in the off cycle. And they mentioned that we had no geographic alignment within the state either. And they mentioned that in order for them to invest the billions and billions of dollars, they needed stability and they needed a partnership of all the power centers. That how and why things would change in the future, they did not know, but they needed somebody that they could collaborate with to keep their product fresh and to keep it competitive. That is not the definition of Michigan. And 14 years later, 15 years later, we are still in the same dynamic. We're not cohesive. In many respects, we're toxic. And big business is not going to make the kind of investments in our state that we need during this most critical time of this electric vehicle revolution, which hasn't happened in 100 years, this kind of change that we're facing. And so far, let's say in the first three innings of a 9-inning ball game, we are not doing well at all as a state. And you can just look in the newspapers and the lawsuits and the dialogue between our political parties to see that there's zero alignment in the state of Michigan. And I speak about this quite a bit, and everybody that I talk to agrees 100%. And so what's the problem? Why can't we resolve this? And I'm still looking for that solution.
Can that discussion be a part of building Michigan better together?
Yes, of course. I mean, the governor, when she asked me to co-chair this, I had my list of demands. One of them was that it would be truly bipartisanship. We would also have great diversity, a gender balance, and also a political fairness in the whole effort. And she agreed, and I had a lot of rope during the process of selecting the over 100-person council and work groups. And I was very surprised and encouraged. Now, whether at the end of the day, my belief that all mankind can enjoy intellectual tension, can deal in an environment of trust, openness, direct conversation, and ultimately reach a consensus remains to be seen. But so far, the work groups have impressed me greatly with the kind of discussions that they've had, the areas that they are delving into, and I still have very, very great hopes that they'll come forth with a dozen great, great priority recommendations that we can forward to the governor.
Recommendations and action need their own promoters. What happens after the report?
Well, you know, hopefully there'll be a big enough consensus. You know, it's our intention to go around the state, have a big listening tour, engage the citizenry in these recommendations. Look, everybody in the state wants the same thing, a better life for themselves and a better life for their kids. And it starts with education. And our K-12 system is totally broken. We've fallen from the mid-20s in terms of ranking in the United States to the mid-40s. We've got a lot of work to do in education. Our infrastructure is broken. Our roads aren't fixed. Our bridges are crumbling. We need to get our infrastructure back in shape. We have one of the best higher education systems in the United States. University of Michigan, Wayne State, Michigan State University, just to name the three big, are all fantastic places to learn. And then finally, you know, we have the culture here. We are a very hardworking state. Everybody wants to see the state move forward. So what's the problem? Why are we allowing politics to dictate the future of this great state?
Thank you. We have 1 second left. So big thank you. I was going to outline the wonderful comments and advice and wisdom you shared, but everybody will watch this tape twice. Thank you, Ambassador.
To contact Junia, send her an email at juniadonesthespark@gmail.com. For more information, program schedules, and news about future guests, go to www.juniadonethespark.com. Thank you for joining us. See you next time on Junia Doan's The Spark.
Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.